Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to some of the folks from the Improvising Composer event at Santa Fe Complex. I'm happy now to welcome Liz Canner. Her new documentary film is called Orgasm, Inc., The Strange Science of Female Pleasure, and it screens at the CCA here in Santa Fe tomorrow, Friday the 5th of March at 5:45. Liz Canner will be present. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me here, Mary Charlotte. I really appreciate it.
So this is a very interesting film, and it's funny how you got into it. You were hired to do some film work for a pharmaceutical company that was trying to develop a Viagra type of drug for women, and your experience there raised a lot of questions about money and medicine and their somewhat uneasy interaction. What did you see when you started working at this company that led you to make this documentary film?
Well, it's kind of funny. I actually didn't set out to make an exposé on the pharmaceutical industry. What happened was, I'm a documentary filmmaker, and for about a decade, I had been making documentaries on human rights issues. And one thing that happens when you make documentaries is you look at the footage over and over again. And so I made films on police brutality and homelessness and that kind of thing. And the footage was really starting to wear on me, especially the violent police brutality footage. And so I started to have nightmares. And I decided the next film that I was going to make was going to be on something pleasurable. And then I thought, well, I'll make a documentary on women and science and pleasure. What has medicine said about women and pleasure? What has science said? So I was sort of looking more at the history. And then through a friend, I was offered this job at a pharmaceutical company that was developing an orgasm cream for women. And I thought, well, this will give me the inside look and the contemporary look at what science is saying about women and pleasure. So I took the job and went to work for the company. And initially, we worked remotely. We were actually editing in Boston. They were based in California. And I gained permission to film the company. And so I filmed them periodically over a few years. And basically, what I discovered through this whole process was that the pharmaceutical industry is not only involved with developing drugs, but they're also now involved with developing diseases. In that Vivus, the company that I worked for, but mostly I would say it was Pfizer, really, when Viagra came out, they saw that that was a huge blockbuster for men, and the thought was that there'll be an even bigger market for women, but the problem was they had to figure out what disease women had in order to develop a drug. That's what the FDA requires you to do. You have to have a disease to come up with a drug, because you have to know when the person's cured, basically, and you have to know, you know, what's wrong with them. So initially it was Pfizer that hired a consultant to handpick the doctors that then eventually came up with female sexual dysfunction and the definition of that disease. And 18 of the 19 doctors who actually came up with the definition for female sexual dysfunction had a tie to 22 drug companies, and the 19th was an FDA official. So as you can see, there was a very deep connection between the pharmaceutical industry and the creation of female sexual dysfunction.
Well, this is a very interesting process, because the inventing of disorders for what previously had been considered either human character traits or human differences between one person and the next, or just kind of vicissitudes of being alive, are now medicalized. And we women know that from our history as having been called hysterical, hysteria, having been made a disease, and now that looks sort of ridiculously quaint, but there's lots of things like that going on now.
Right. One of the actual disease categories is hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which I think prior to, you know, the 50s, back at least in the Victorian era, would have been called frigidity. So there's been sort of this re-marketing and re-thinking, but then once again, bring it back as a disorder, women's sexuality, and trying to create the sense that women are supposed to have a certain type of sexuality in order to be healthy and normal, when there's absolutely nothing out there that says women are supposed to have, you know, 10 orgasms a month to be healthy, or 20 sexual thoughts in a day to be healthy and have enough desire. There's no normal when it comes to sexuality. So in some ways, that's actually complicated it for the pharmaceutical companies, and I think in a way that they never imagined it would.
It's funny. I was recently watching the biopic called Kinsey on cable TV, and Kinsey, of course, made famous by the Kinsey Report, was a scientist who studied human sexuality. And one of the things that became so clear when you read his work or even just see that film is that, as you say, there is absolutely no such thing as normal in human sexuality, but rather there's just a very wide variety of behavior and thoughts and so on. But no matter how often this is proven, we still live in a society, and I think this goes far beyond health and sexuality, that is forever trying to set standards of normal and then trying to get the rest of us to conform through therapeutic or medical intervention if necessary.
Right. I think that there's this long tradition. I mean, you know, Kinsey was very good at sort of debunking the normal, but there is this long tradition throughout history of creating a normal so that then the cure can be presented by doctors, that then you're going to need to go to your doctor to be... And I don't even think it's just medicine. It's also religion has created an idea of what normal sexuality is. And we have sex education that says you should abstain. I mean, I think there's a lot of ways that the state and churches and medicine have tried to really impose an idea of what our sexuality should be like in a lot of ways to control us and to get money from us. If you look back at Victorian times when they were talking about, you know, normal sexuality, so to speak, one of the things that you mentioned was hysteria, and the way you treated that was with vibrators. Doctors were using vibrators to actually treat women who had hysteria, and it was a weekly visit, and doctors got very wealthy with this kind of treatment. And you can see that again now with this attempt to try and come up with some sort of female Viagra. You know, Viagra itself sells for $10 a pill. It's a huge moneymaker. So if we could sort of create this idea that there's a normal way people are supposed to be having sex and then sell a product for it, it's very profitable.
Your film highlights this process in which a pharmaceutical company takes some statistics from a medical study, then issues press releases that then get picked up by TV news shows, and as these things often happen, they're kind of just read straight from the press release. And you noticed that this statistic kept coming up. It kept being reported 43%. What did that 43% refer to?
Right, yes. I mean, 43%, I mean, it's still used, as you said, it's still used now. And it's basically a marketing term. We really have to look at it that way. It's a marketing term in two ways. One, it's supposed to make a lot of women think if they're having sexual problems, which is very normal. Who doesn't have sexual problems at some point in their life? To think that, oh, I must be one of those 43%. And it's also a way to think for the pharmaceutical industry to say to their stockholders and to the general, you know, people on Wall Street, this is going to be a huge market, so you want to invest in us. You know, our stock is valuable.
Back up a second. What 43% of who has what, according to this number?
Right, according to this number. This is one of the things that really tipped me off when I was working for the drug industry, because I had never, you know, I'd done all this research, and I had never come across, first of all, the term female sexual dysfunction. And then when I was doing these videos, I actually had to put this screen up that said, you know, 43% of women suffer from female sexual dysfunction, and it was something like, you know, you might be one of these, and this is why you're participating in this study. And I'm like, 43%? Okay, why didn't my mother tell me? I mean, if almost half of us have this disease, why don't my girlfriends tell me? Why is nobody talking about this? You know, if all of us have this disorder. So 43% was a term. I mean, even Oprah picked it up. As you said, it got taken over by the media. I mean, Oprah says it's, you know, 43% of sexual dysfunction. It's a silent epidemic. You know, talk show host after talk show host, the Berman sisters, they were promoting it. It really took off. And where it comes from is an actual survey that was done in the early 90s by a sociologist who was just looking at, you know, women's sexual experience. It wasn't a survey to actually look at sexual dysfunction. And the questions that were asked were things like, do you orgasm too quickly? Or do you sometimes not feel like having sex? Or, you know, very broad questions. And basically, if you answered yes to these, and it had to be that you'd experienced them regularly over a two-month period, that this eventually got turned in. And they were just looking at, you know, trying to figure out people's sexual experience. And this got changed You know, in the late 90s, when female sexual dysfunction came out, an article was put in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and that 43% was switched around, and now they said 43% of women have female sexual dysfunction. So it was never meant to even be a study that looked at something like sexual dysfunction, and you know, because it didn't exist at that period, at least that term. So so it got turned around into this new meaning that then got picked up, as you pointed out, by the media, and has certainly been used to try and make women think that there's something wrong with them, when for most women it's probably ordinary life experiences. Now, I should say that some women do actually have real sexual problems that are created by medical conditions. If you have had a radical hysterectomy, that can affect your levels of desire. If you've been taking antidepressants, that can also affect desire and orgasmic function. There's a whole variety of things. Diabetes can affect sexual function. So there's a whole variety of sort of medical conditions that this is a symptom, you know, one of the symptoms that goes along with those conditions. So it's not to say that some women don't actually have real medical conditions. It's just that the majority of women, certainly not 43% of women, actually have sexual dysfunction. For most women, it's things like relationship problems, sexual abuse plays a huge part in women's experience of sexuality. Certainly, you know, equality in the workplace, being stressed due to overwork because we're still doing 40 hours of work in the workplace and then a lot of the work in the domestic sphere. I mean, there's just a lot of reasons that women experience sex in a way that may not be always fun and wonderful.
I mean, and one of the things that comes out in the film, you know, we're just tired. I mean, women who have numbers of children and are juggling a million things, tiredness then becoming medicalized, it really makes you wonder how crazy this is.
Right, right. But now you have a headache and you don't feel like having sex, partly because, you know, as you said, you've been taking care of the kids all day, cleaning the house, you know, working 40 hours, it's, you know, in the workplace. Women are just overtaxed, and I keep thinking, you know, and I'd like to say this to the drug industry. I mean, I want them to develop a pill, and I think this pill would really help. A pill that, you know, stopped sexual abuse, a pill that created equality in the workplace, a pill that created equality in the domestic sphere, a pill that, you know, caused everyone to have good sex education so they knew about things like the clitoris. You know, that kind of pill, that would really help us more than testosterone that it can give us breast cancer and probably doesn't even help us experience more desire anyways. You know, a lot of the drugs are quite strong that we need to take regularly. The side effects for some of them are quite extreme, you know, potential side effects. Not everyone's certainly going to get them. But, you know, I think that there are things that we could work on to change our society that would give women much more pleasure and much more sex, basically.
We're talking to Liz Kanner, filmmaker. Her new documentary is called Orgasm, Inc., The Strange Science of Female Pleasure. So one of the speakers in your film is a professor who basically says, look, you can't talk about sex and sexuality in isolation. It would be tantamount to, you know, asking to thinking about friendship. How many friendship feelings have you had in the last month? That kind of thing. I mean, friendship is a relationship. It's a social interaction. And in the same way, to try to isolate sexuality in that way, it doesn't even really make sense.
No, it's true. It's funny, you know, one of the drugs right now that's being proposed is by Boehringer Ingelheim, and it's called flibanserin. And a few months ago, there was a big media flurry around it because they announced positive results in their clinical trial. And this drug basically gives you 0.8 sexual events, satisfying sexual events a month above placebo, 0.8 satisfying sexual events above placebo. And it was really interesting. I was debating one of their doctors on a news program in California, and this woman called in, and flibanserin is actually supposed to be for desire. It's not even supposed to be for increasing sexual events, but that's what the sort of propaganda that the company has been putting out has been really focusing on, that not so much increasing desire, but they say this is going to increase your desire. And this woman called in, and I think she so nailed it. She said, you know, basically I was in a marriage for 30 years, and my husband and I stopped communicating well. I stopped having interest in him sexually. I stopped having interest in sex. And then I started having an affair, and all of a sudden, all of my sexual thoughts came back, and I started having fabulous sex, and I realized there was nothing wrong with me. It's just that I needed to change my partner. So, you know, I think there's unfortunately something there, that that, you know, there is something that happens in long-term relationships, especially if they're not very functional, and even, you know, short-term relationships that aren't functional, that really affect our experience of sexuality. And there's this really great cartoon that's from The New Yorker, that this couple in bed, and the wife turns to the husband, and they're both clearly, like, not having a conversation. And she says, "I wish there was a pill for conversations." You know, right. I mean, I think that a lot of this has to do with communication and better communication. And certainly also communicating, you know, about what we like and what we don't like in bed with our partners. That also helps. But, you know, I think that that this is a big factor in all of this, definitely.
Well, that was something that I was thinking about while watching your film, which you didn't really address in the film, and perhaps it wasn't the place for it, but the reality that it is extremely difficult to maintain a wonderful sexuality the way it is at the beginning of a relationship, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 and more years in. I mean, that's hard for everybody, and that's not a medical, it's just in no way a medical issue.
Right. Actually, Susan Bennett, and she's a doctor who's in my documentary, who teaches the first class at Harvard Medical School on sexuality, and I interviewed her partly about this, and she talks about how after 7 years, they've done these studies, it looks like most people experience a lowering of their libido, especially women, towards their partner, and it's just normal. I mean, it's just part of the regularity of being with someone. But what she says, and I think this is really true, is that it doesn't mean, she said, just think about it like you go to an ice cream store, and you're with your partner, and he's really hungry, and he orders a sundae. You're not hungry, but he orders you a sundae anyways, and you start eating that ice cream sundae. Now, the ice cream sundae is going to taste really good, and as you eat it, you might want to eat more of the ice cream sundae. And so, you know, I mean, I think that's the case with sexuality. It's like you may not necessarily be in the mood, but if you start, you know, experiencing sex or, you know, having a sexual experience with your partner, that it feels good, you know, and you can still enjoy it. So, you know, I think that there's ways that we can still have pleasurable sex lives, even if the drive isn't quite what it used to be.
So all of this, we started out talking about the pharmaceutical company that you worked for, and Viagra has certainly been a very popular and, I guess, effective drug. But what about the drugs that were being tested on women that you were experiencing? Did they work?
Yeah, that was one thing. This documentary took me 9 years, which is a long time to be covering a story. And part of the reason was that I kept hearing in the news and hearing from the drug companies, we're going to come out with a drug this year. We're going to come out with a drug next year, you know. And that was going to be the end of my film. They're going to come out with their drug. Our culture shifts around sexuality. That's the end. Well, the reality is that, you know, for instance, Pfizer tested Viagra on women, and the assumption was, because Viagra worked on men, it caused, you know, erections. And by the way, Viagra doesn't actually cause orgasms in men, so if they have orgasmic problems, it doesn't help with that. But, it does cause erection in men. And they assumed that this was something women wanted, that they all wanted their genitals to be engorged. Well, I don't know if they ever asked a woman, but that's not something I personally ever noticed, if I'm engorged. So what they discovered was, yes, Viagra works on women. It makes them engorged. But that doesn't seem to enhance their sexual pleasure that much, and not enough to certainly pursue developing Viagra for women. And in fact, Pfizer came out and said, women are just more complicated than we ever imagined around sexuality. So, you know, I think that there's this assumption that men and women are the same, and that, you know, these drugs that worked on men were then going to work on women. So that was initially, they started out with developing these drugs that were sort of physical, that dealt with our physiology. So when they gave up on that, they started moving into drugs that were more affecting us as beings. So they started developing testosterone, a patch that women would have to wear every single day, called Intrinza, which I actually filmed the FDA hearing, and it turned out that the actual efficacy was very low, and they tested on women who had radical hysterectomies and were taking estrogen along with the testosterone. And some scientists actually argue that testosterone plus estrogen, that actually affects desire. But anyway, so they were testing this patch, and as I mentioned earlier, testosterone is known to have quite serious side effects. And it turned out that it didn't really work enough for it to be approved in the United States. It then went on to get approved in the EU, but it wasn't efficacious enough for it to be approved here. And certainly there was a lot of concern about off-label marketing, where it would get shown on television like, you know, the next Viagra, but it had only been tested on women who had radical hysterectomies who were taking replacement estrogen. So therefore, you know, in terms of clinical trials, it had only been shown to work on a very small number of women. So that was not approved. But there's been a lot of other drugs in the pipeline, and most of them have not actually worked enough. But there are these two coming out this year. One's a testosterone drug, and one is also this flibanserin, which was initially being tested for as an antidepressant. But when they found it really wasn't working for depression, but maybe it was increasing desire, they changed their study, and so now it's being looked at for female sexual dysfunction. So those are the two that are coming down the pike. But for the most part, there's been a lot of failure at coming up with a drug, and I think because sexuality is so unique to the individual, and with women, engorgement just isn't enough to increase their pleasure. So I think that's part of the reason, basically.
Right. Another point that was made in the film was, and I didn't know this number, but that we in the United States use 45% of the world's prescription drugs. That means we have 5% of the population, so we use 9 times as much prescription drugs, as many prescription drugs, as the whole rest of the world. That's crazy.
Yes, that's how much we spend, 9 times more. It is true that that we use the world's, the most of pharmaceuticals. Part of that is that we don't have nationalized health care. In other countries, they are more protected from taking drugs that they probably don't need. The other reason that we are taking so many pharmaceuticals, and I'm sure everyone listening knows people who are taking pharmaceuticals regularly because it's become such a common part of our culture, is that in the late 90s, as part of all the deregulation that went on, the FCC deregulated around drug ads. So now we see drug ads on television constantly, and we, along with New Zealand, are the only countries in the world that actually allow direct-to-consumer advertising of pharmaceuticals. And this has really transformed our culture in a lot of ways, not only in the fact that now we are self-diagnosing, because a lot of the ads are for conditions that are very vague, things like having trouble sleeping or, restless leg syndrome or, shyness, which is now called social anxiety disorder. And along with this sort of allowing of direct-to-consumer advertising has been this shift of medicalizing everyday life, so that things that once were considered, just part of existence now have disease names, and often these names were actually coined on Madison Avenue, so they would be more marketable to us. Erectile dysfunction, ED, that's an easy acronym, which used to be called impotence, by the way. So there's all these ways that we have subtly been manipulated to start to think that we have disorders when we probably don't, or we could do things by changing our lifestyle that would improve the condition that we have, as opposed to taking a lot of these pharmaceuticals that cause way more harm than the condition that we're trying to cure. So I think that there's been this dramatic shift, and unfortunately it hasn't made us any healthier. We don't live any longer than people in other countries, but we certainly spend a lot more money, and it's part of the reason our healthcare costs have gotten so high.
And in addition to everything you said, we don't look at the larger causes of the problems we are having. I was reading somewhere, and I don't have the footnote for this, but that in France, people sleep an average of 9 hours a night. And that means that they have jobs and lifestyles and family lives and cooking schedules and things like that that allow them to sleep 9 hours a night, which I would dare say most Americans do not at this point. And so when you think of all the other, stress disorders and sleeplessness and insomnia and relationship problems and sexuality and all these things that spring from being sleep deprived, that's just one of many examples of the kind of thing you're talking about. And in a way, it really invites us to look at, why do we have an economy that forces us to work too long and too hard, and questions like that, which cannot be dealt with by pharmaceutical solutions.
Right. We're sort of, the pharmaceuticals in a way are a Band-Aid over what the real problem is. I mean, I think it's definitely true in countries where they have things like socialized medicine, where they have a real social safety net, people are more relaxed. It's a much more caring society. We live in a very harsh, America is a very harsh society. We don't believe in helping our neighbors in a real way. And so we have created a culture where we're all stressed out, depressed, and these drugs we need in some ways to help us sleep better, as you said, because, we don't get a few hours, then we have trouble, but we're so stressed out, it's hard to sleep. I mean, I think it's a real problem that we have not created a beloved society, so to speak. And so it makes us open for these kinds of interventions. And it's really unfortunate. And I think that we're, you know, as we become more and more of a polarized society, we're becoming very mean-spirited, and it's upsetting.
Well, it's just about time to go. There's a lot more in the film that we haven't talked about, things like cosmetic surgery and so on. But we've got to go. Liz Kanner will be in Santa Fe tomorrow night, Friday the 5th of March, screening her documentary Orgasm, Inc., The Strange Science of Female Pleasure at the CCA, the Center for Contemporary Arts, here in Santa Fe. The website is ccasantafe.org. The phone number is 505-982-1338. And Liz Kanner, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Do you have a website for the film?
Yes, it's www.orgasminc.org. If you can believe it, that URL was available. So we have it.
Great. Good. Well, we'll see you tomorrow night.
Yes, thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome composers and multimedia artists James Brody and Phil Mantione. They are part of a day-long event which is happening this Saturday at Santa Fe Complex called The Improvising Composer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So what's this event all about?
Well, it's as you say, it's a day-long event. During the day, there's several workshops. There are six composers involved. Myself and James, Martin Back, William Fowler Collins, J.A. Dean, and Christian Pincock are also involved. And each of us will do a workshop slash demonstration of basically how we're using technology in our work and how we use it to make music. And so those will be starting at 10 a.m. They'll go all day long. And then at 6 o'clock, there's a panel discussion where we'll talk about improvisation in general. And probably also technology, and that's moderated by Craig Smith.
Wonderful journalist for many
writer.
Years with the Pasatiempo, and sometimes still.
Right. And so that'll go till about 7:15, 7:30, and then at 8 o'clock, each of us will do a solo piece, and then that will be followed by a group improvisation. And it's going to be the first time we've all played together as a group, so it should be a lot of fun.
So both of you consider yourselves multimedia artists as well as composers. Have things changed in a significant way from the times of, say, Mozart or Beethoven? I mean, would they have considered themselves in any way multimedia artists? What's different now? What's the same?
Well, first of all, they were multimedia artists because they wrote operas and ballets and so forth. But the multimedia part of it has to do with the use of technology in the visual realm or in the dance realm. I myself am mostly involved in the audio realm or the sound, the sound is music as sound realm, but I've done some visual pieces with other composers, with other artists. I would say more the composition aspect rather than the multimedia aspect is what's most important to me, how to get something I'm doing to sound over a period of time.
What are the elements of your own work, James Brody? In other words, what are your media? I mean, are you composing for the violin?
Well, I've done composing for regular instruments, but right now I'm very interested in using the computer to record sounds and manipulate them. When I first started composing in this way, it was on magnetic tape, and you had these tiny little pieces of tape that you would scotch tape to the wall and pull off what you need and then splice them together. Now that's all done on the computer.
And life is so much easier now.
Well,
in that respect.
In a certain way, but you still have to make it sound. And that's the challenge. To make, yeah.
What about you, Phil?
Well, I've written also for acoustic instruments, orchestral things, and chamber music. I've kind of gone more towards computer in the last, 10 years, I guess. For practical reasons, for aesthetic reasons, it's kind of difficult to find an orchestra to experiment with, number one, or just to get something performed, number two. So... it kind of, I don't know about other composers that have better opportunities, but I found myself going more towards the computer because it was kind of self-contained. You could really experiment. You can do, you can imagine something and then realize it immediately. So there was this kind of feedback that I think accelerates the way that you compose.
When you say you can imagine something and then realize it immediately, are you using the computer in such a way that you are using programs that imitate the sounds of acoustic instruments?
No, that's not something that really appeals to me, because there's, as good as orchestral samples can be, they always fall short of the real thing. And also, I mean, I've always thought, why would you limit yourself to things that are already real? Why not create something that's not real? So,
what is the nature of the sound that you're working with?
I work with samples, things that I record myself, things that I come across, and manipulate them in strange ways.
What is this for our audience driving to work? What is a sample?
Sample is a recording. It's basically a recording. It could be a recording of something, dropping on the floor. It could be a field recording where you're just, walking through the woods with a set of binaural microphones on and just recording what's happening.
So it's basically found sound from daily life in one way or another.
Right. You can contrive it in that you can say, I'm going to record this, or you might just record something by accident and say, that's a great sound, and I'm going to use it. Yeah.
If I set the microphone outdoors during a certain part of the day, I might record an hour and a half of sound. Then I go through it very carefully, and I pick out the tiny little parts of the thing that appeal to me and seem like they might find their way into a composition. A sample, essentially, is a way of encoding a sound so it works on the computer. LP kind of analog recording, where you had an actual physical thing vibrating to make the sound, isn't the way the computer works. The computer chops the sound up into many tiny segments, 44,000 a second, and
or more,
and then puts them back together, and it gives an impression of the sound, or gives a representation of the sound
in a way that the human oral apparatus hears, not as a chopped up sound, but as a smooth sound.
Exactly.
I want to make sure that we get to hear work by both composers. James Brody, we're going to hear a piece by you called Zazon.
Yes.
And that's a fairly recent piece. Tell us about what we're about to hear.
Well, first of all, the piece came as a dream.
Really?
It came as a dream. First of all, I was on a train, and the name of the town was Zazon.
Where was that?
Well...
Oh, in your dream.
In my dream, yeah. Uh-huh. And also, some of the sounds that are on the piece are sounds from childhood that were arrived at not directly, but through use of different softwares. And the whole idea is that people listen to atmospheres of sound all the time when they're walking down the street. The kind of composition that I like to do concentrates that whole listening experience into a kind of a world of sound.
Now, that is something, I mean, I remember when I first encountered the music, sound, and aesthetics of John Cage and had to suddenly listen to the world around me as if it were worth listening to, as opposed to being something that we filter out. And human beings are very good at filtering out extraneous sounds. We hope that's true of the people listening at home or in their cars right now who are filtering out the sounds of the Santa Fe Baking Company. But why do you... I mean, tell us about that experience of really learning to listen to and focusing on this world of sound that we move through.
Well, I had my teacher who first of all, he was in the wars of resistance in Greece, and he talked about hearing the way a political demonstration suddenly became disturbed by the gunshots, and everybody started screaming and running different directions. There was that one thing. Then I had another teacher who said...
You're talking about Xenakis there.
That's Xenakis, yeah. Yanis Xenakis. And then another teacher, Franz Kamen, who said, why don't you just devote a day to listening? Because, first of all, it will illuminate your music.
And where were you when you did that?
I think I was in Pennsylvania.
So you devoted a whole day to just being quiet and listening?
Yes, walking around, listening to everything. Also recording it. And as you put it on a recorder, you're listening to it about 10 times louder than it usually is. So a neighborhood of with children playing three blocks away, you can hear those children screaming and all that kind of thing. Or you can hear the wind in the trees, or you can hear the creaking of branches in the wind, or very, very interesting, or the kind of interference of machinery, or a jet plane has a fabulous sound, you know, that the people just, they block it out, or they don't really listen to it intensely. So I would say that's the source of the sound, and then because people lose interest in what they're hearing in real life, the job of the composer is to concentrate the listening experience through composing the sounds, perhaps into a different form than they might have had just in real life.
Now, do you use the tools that classical and Baroque and Romantic and so on music have given us in your compositions?
That's an interesting question because I think there's a misconception of what the tools are.
In harmony.
Harmony is different than the rules that the theorists give us. Harmony creates an intention of an emotional experience that the composer wanted to create and used harmony, and then the theorists come along and they analyze it and they say, this is happening, that's happening. But what's really happening was a sequence of experience that was related to tone. And so rather than, so in 100 years or 200 years, there will be those who have to talk about the experience of sounds in the same way. There's a whole genre of music called microtonal music, in which the sound, where you might have 40 notes per octave rather than the usual 12, and the whole language of what it means to make chords out of these sounds has never been examined. As to what the meaning of the chord might be, like we know a minor chord has sadness to it, and a major chord has...
I would think there'd be tremendous scope for using microtonal thinking when you're using samples from everyday life, because
the composer Xenakis used a lot of sliding tones or glissandi in his music, and that whole language is just emerging as to what it really is, kind of a depiction of speed, perhaps, or the changing of speed.
Well, let's hear an excerpt from Sazon by James Brody. We'll be back in a second. Thank you. Once again, the piece is called Zazon by James Brody. Now, let's go to Phil Montione, and we're going to hear some of your music as well.
Okay. I think what you're going to play here is it's a piece called Dial Tone and Strings. And I wrote it in response to sort of an online thing called Sound Lab based in Cologne. And they're celebrating 10th anniversary, and this piece is going to be included in their collection. And part of what they wanted to do is look for pieces that spoke to the idea of sound as a communicative device. And in my response to, you know, they wanted me to write about it. And, when I've written music in the past, music as music, not for some other, you know, for video or something else, I haven't really thought about communicating anything per se other than the sound of the music itself. And maybe that you can say that it communicates something, but I wasn't really thinking in terms of anything verbal or textual in any way. So I was trying to think, well, how can I approach this? And I have a piece called Traffic for Strings that I wrote several years ago that was for a string chamber orchestra. And that piece was based on a field recording that I made. I was living in Queens at the time. Queens, New York. And it was on a very busy street right before you enter the Triborough Bridge. That was our first place, my wife and I leased upon, and when we moved there, it was just incredible to me, the traffic and the kind of license that New York drivers give to using their car horns.
Yeah.
I mean, they really talk with their horns, and it's...
And what they say isn't necessarily very nice.
It's not usually nice, but there's a whole range of emotion there, you know. But anyway, at first it was just incredible, and I stuck the mic out the window and I recorded, you know, for several hours, and then I just kind of put it away for a while, and then after I don't know, maybe 6 months of hearing this traffic every day, it became less beautiful and more annoying. And
I'm amazed that it was beautiful at first.
It was, well, I don't know, I have a certain mindset. But, you know, when you're trying to do other things and you're continually hearing this, it can get distracting. So I was into this idea of using sounds that annoyed me to make music so that they wouldn't annoy me anymore at the time. And I also wrote a piece called Radiator because we had this really clanking radiator in the kitchen that would, like, incredible hissing and banging sounds, and would just do it whenever it wanted to. Anyway, I took this field recording after actually several years, and I transcribed it based on the pitches of the horns. I actually tried to find a fundamental for the diesel engines going by, and I transcribed it in real time with accurate durations, and then I expanded those durations, probably 10 to 20 times. And then orchestrated for strings. And I took some liberties and some, you know, using intuition and how to kind of use that as a structure. And so that piece it's one of my favorite pieces. And the reason I went into that long story about the Traffic for Strings piece is because it was, at its fundamental, it was based on sound used as a communicative device. Car horns.
Right. Okay.
It's kind of the most fundamental use of sound, and the other source that I use was dial tone, and there are several types of dial tones that you hear on a phone. There's a busy signal. There's the ringing sound. There's the disconnected sound. So I use, and those are communicating very specific things that almost everyone knows.
And there's this tremendous urge to make them go away.
Yeah. Or yes, just stop. But you know, there are tones in there. There are very clear tones, and it's good kind of fodder for computer manipulation. So those two things combined. And I've always wanted to use the acoustic recording of the string piece because it's very rich timbrally, and when you take a very rich sound to begin with, and you start to do things in the computer with it. It's a lot of fun. So those two things combined are the way this thing came about.
So that's what we're about to hear.
Right.
Okay, let's hear it. We'll be back to yourself. And once again, that was a composition by Phil Montione. We're talking to Phil Montione and James Brody, who are two of the composers in the improvising composer day-long event at Santa Fe Complex. So let's talk a little bit about this event. Who's it for? There's a bunch of composers, as you said before, who are participating in it. Who are going to be the attendees? Musicians, composers?
Well, the workshops are going to be talking specifics about software, technology. And you might say, well, if I'm not a composer, why should I come? Well, I think anyone that wants to really see and get some insight into, if they're listening to new music, adventuresome music, and they really want to know, how is it being made? What's the process? These workshops, because they're only an hour long, are not going to be so esoteric that someone wouldn't understand what's happening. And I think we're all aware of that, and we'll approach them with that kind of mentality. So anyone interested in seeing how composers are writing and making sound would be interested. And also if you're a visual artist, which I know there's tons of in Santa Fe, looking to get into any kind of sound production for their work, installation work, video work, it's a good kind of survey of the software being used in unusual ways. So,
do you collaborate with visual artists, James?
I recently did a collaboration where we did a film and music or sound exploration of the Big Bang at the
beginning. My goodness.
And it was really an impression piece, not really, you can't really...
You didn't record the actual Big Bang.
Actually, I've used that, which is the, if you have a Geiger counter listening to the cosmic background radiation, the clicks, that is the residue from the Big Bang, at least according to some scientists. But anyway, I'm very interested in that. So we just did a kind of impression of the Big Bang. And we played it for scientists, and they said, no, it was nothing like that. But that doesn't really matter, because we learned a lot doing it. So that was my most recent collaboration with this visual artist.
Very interesting. Well, it's just about time to go. The Improvising Composer day-long event is at Santa Fe Complex with several composers, including James Brody and Phil Montione, who we have here with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, as well as Martin Back, William Fowler Collins, J.A. Dean, Christian Pinkock. And for more information, people can call 466-4832. They can visit sfcomplex.org and click on the Improvising Composer. They can also just show up in the morning, I think, right, at 10 o'clock a.m., or do they have to register in advance?
No, you can. I'm sure there'll be... There'll be some availability.
And the panel discussion is at 6 o'clock, and then the concert is at 8 in the evening.
Correct.
Well, thank you all so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features Artist of the Month, Horace Silver.